Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is a Friday. Friday, January 28th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. And through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, if you go there and click on the Why Again link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link, download it, copy it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. Once you do that, you'll have access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. There's also a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one. And sometimes people call in with comments or questions. A lot of times they call in with testimonials. Sometimes they call in and we actually work them through a worksheet process. Repeated use of those audio files can serve as a tutorial. And I know people who have done a tremendous amount of their own personal work just by listening to those shows over and over again and gotten to be quite good at benefiting from the use of the tool. So if you've done any of that, if you've got comments or questions, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you are kind enough to call that number and press 1, it'll put the little phone icon or hand icon by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. And as I like to say, we greatly appreciate when people do that, as it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. Our intention with this work is to be of service. So please keep that in mind. It makes it easier for us if you give us a call and either let us know how you're feeling about what's being said or a question or a comment, or if there's any way we can actually help you process something. We've been working with the Way of Mastery beginning on the 10th of this month, the first 10 days of this year. were spent deciding what we would do as a theme. So now we've landed on the way of mastery. And I was going to add one last piece from the blog post I was reading. It was written in 2010 by JM, the gentleman who gave us access to the Way of Mastery material. And he's been writing in this blog post about, you know, his answer to a listener, a participant, a student from the Way of Mastery, asking about what's the difference between A Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery and where do they conflict. And he said, well, you know, conflict is perceived in the mind of the person. It's created in the mind of the person who perceives conflict. And so with spiritual teachings that are highly advanced, as both of these teachings are, there is no conflict. So that's where he began. And then he started talking about one of the ways that so many people in the Course in Miracles set up a dichotomy and say the world is not real and therefore whatever anybody else discusses from the Way of Mastery or Course in Miracles that talks about any need to do anything to get more in touch with the loving self, to be embracing of others, is unnecessary. And so, you know, there's this set of perceptions that people develop when they read A Course in Miracles, and some people develop it to say the world isn't real and the people I'm interacting with aren't really real, and so I don't need to do anything. I don't need to be gentle with them. I don't need to be gentle with myself. It's just all just meaningless. And James is offering a very different perspective. He says, near the end of this blog post, he says that as love is restored or remembered, compassion for the whole of creation arises, and the very energy of desire goes through its final quantum shift. It goes from desire for egoic safety, egoic fulfillment, egoic meaning, through the desire to awaken from ego, and into the desire to serve love's healing of creation's only son, which means everything that has come from creation. Every being yet imprisoned in the suffering of a fully illusory separation gets awakened, gets healed, gets liberated, and extracted from the vicious cycle of guilt, fear, and projection. This is why there is no liberation for the self, but only from the self, the little s self, the sense of identification with a personal identity. And it's a liberation from that identification with a personal identity into the whole of actuality, of reality. Behold, for the Creator looked upon all he had created and said, quote, it is very good, close quotes. And when there is seeing with the Creator's consciousness, what is seen is suffused in holiness. And what is holy drips and oozes with beauty. The sipping of a cup of coffee becomes what it could never be, while the veil of separation, the ego self, seemed to yet demand contraction in guilt and fear. To become, quote, ego-less, close quotes, is not to see that nothing really exists, but that what ego projected was unreal, to awaken as the energy of love itself in and under all conditions. It is not to be finally obliterated. It is to be finally and fully existent as the essence of existence itself. What we all need to do is, I think, give up the notion that one form of teaching is complete and then cling to it doggedly, thus confusing the very purpose of the teaching as a tool with the real goal that the teaching was designed for. The real goal the teaching is designed for is to wake us up from all illusion, wake us up from the dream of separation, to help us all be ceaselessly devoted to learning the power of innocence, the power of deepening presence in wonder and curiosity, and letting every moment teach us more deeply of the love that God and creation is, and teach us of the potential of love for dissolving all that may impede the extension of true creation in, as, and for this moment, this one precious eternal moment, for this is heaven itself. In the end, A Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery are not the least bit important. What matters is the fruit they blossom in us, as us, through us, and for all beings in every single moment, and with each and every breath. I'm only interested in the journey of all souls into their own immediate and fulfilled enlightenment. I'll leave it to the academically inclined to compare and contrast The Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery. I think somewhere Yeshua has stated that this is exactly what ego does. Blessings from JM. So, birthing the awareness that your very existence and the ability to be aware is the energy of creation expressing in form, expressing in consciousness, expressing in, through, as, and around you in each new present moment. And the more you can become conscious of that, directly conscious of that in each new present moment, the more you are living into what is hoped for with any true spiritual teaching. Spiritual teachings are not given so people write them down and people create schools about them and people create religions with them. Spiritual teachings, the true spiritual teachings, are created as, Guy Finley says, there is one true, invisible, cosmic curriculum. And the purpose of the curriculum is to educate the consciousness to the existence of the power and the creative intelligence that gave birth to the curriculum. The only curriculum is the steps, the experience, the work, the words that help people wake up to the existence of all creation and their role in it. So in The Way of Mastery, we're in right near the end of the second lesson. And I was talking about reading in the book where it talks about practicing the first two axioms. These are the first two axioms of The Way of the Heart. The first one is found on page 5 of The Way of the Heart, and it says, nothing you experience or everything you experience is the result of your own choice and nothing else. And that's what the first two lessons are trying to wake us up to, the idea that our culture has trained us and conditioned us completely differently than the truth of life. The first axiom and the first step of awakening in this pathway is to just allow, begin to let it into your mind, this axiom of truth. And here's the quote. Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice. And then, here are the first two axioms combined. I am created as my Creator created me to be. I am free. And nothing sources my experience but me in each moment. Nothing has an effect on me whatsoever except that which I choose to allow to affect me. I need do nothing. The book goes on to say, in the beginning, we would suggest that you practice this second axiom in the morning and in the evening as you are arising and as you are retiring. At least twice in each of your days, we ask that you cultivate for 5 minutes the repetition of this thought so that you begin to feel it in your bones. I need do nothing. This will come as quite a shock to your consciousness, and the mind will say, but I have all these things I have to do. What about this? What about that? Oh my goodness, will the world stop spinning if I'm stopped needing? That's up to the world, not up to you. The power of these first two axioms will be what everything else is built upon. Let everything that follows be merely a way of watering those two axioms and making them an anchor for your awareness. For when the anchor is firmly in place, you will literally create whatever you so desire from perfect freedom and from perfect deliberateness. You will even transcend miracle-mindedness, for miracle-mindedness is still a stage of perception, which is just short of mastery. Mastery comes when you know that you are literally and deliberately creating. There is nothing miraculous about it. You will decree a thing, and it shall be so. That is to create as creation creates. For while creation marvels at you, it knows perfectly well that your creation was not a miracle. It was very deliberate, born from the pure radiance of love. The Creator does not sit on a throne and say, I wonder if I'm worthy to create my children. I wonder if I'm worthy to express myself through the divine spark of consciousness that they are. Never does it enter into the holy mind of creation. Huh, I wonder if it's okay if I create a solar system. A thought is received and a thought emanates within the mind. It is decreed and it is so. Creation looks upon all things and says, it is very good. So here's an exercise in conscious creation. The third and last exercise we would give you in this lesson is this. Choose something that you do every day. Something that you are convinced is so utterly ordinary that it certainly does not hold any power or any spiritual meaning whatsoever. It could be something as simple as having a glass of water, brushing your teeth, or even yawning. Pick something that you know you do every day and decide to make that the focus of your worship. So that when you do it, you stop and you say, it is very good. Even if it is something as simple as raising your head from the pillow, become aware of it, own it as self-created, and as you contemplate that action, say to yourself, it is very good. I have done this, and it is good. I have created. Again, those that are truly committed will find that they begin to enjoy this process, and they begin to apply it more and more to other events in their lives. They begin to reawaken the childlike joy of building a castle in the sandbox. For in truth, that is all you are doing here. Consciousness is your sandbox. And you are creating castles. You have simply forgotten to enjoy them. When you want to be rid of them, you now lament, okay, but if I give this up and change my mind and move on, what will happen to my creations? What will others think of me if I act like a child and just take my little plastic shovel and knock the castle down and go in and have a sandwich for lunch? What will people think of me? Will I fit in? Will I be accepted? Will I be judged? Will I be persecuted? Who cares? The opinions of others mean nothing, unless, of course, you want them to mean something. So now we come to what concludes this lesson. What blocks you in your mind? For even as you are hearing these words, you may recognize a resistance. That resistance is the energy of fear. What will happen if I follow this path? That part of your mind, called the ego, will rise up and tell you that if you listen to the one that some have called the savior of the world, it will take you on a path of destruction. That is because the voice of ego knows that it will be destroyed if this path is followed. You, the reality of who you are, cannot be destroyed. That resistance is fear. And fear is one of the energies that is out of alignment with the truth of the kingdom. Therefore, fear not, but continue in faith. For I say unto you, what you will discover at the end of this pathway is perfect freedom, perfect power, perfect spaciousness, perfect joy, and perfect peace of living, literally living in the kingdom of heaven. The choice is yours. For those of you that will feel this resistance come up so strongly, and for those of you that will yet call out unto me in your dreams and your prayers, saying, help me through this, I say unto you that you walk not alone. For I cannot be further from you than the width of a thought. And yes, you are the creator of that thought. I too embarked on just such a path. Each axiom that I will share and refine, as well as the many of the exercises that the Way of Mastery are specifically communicating, they are exercises and truths that were given to me from the time I was initiated by certain Essene teachers in the Way of the Heart. When my teacher said, it's time for you to go spend 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, do you not believe that resistance came up within me too? I too had to notice that I was creating a thought of fear. I was separating myself from the great protection and love of creation. I had to physically move the body into the wilderness to move through my own rings of fear, to discover what was on the other side. The pathway that I have walked is the pathway that you are walking. And if our pathway is the same, then we walk together to God, to creation, and away from illusion, pain, weakness, unworthiness, guilt, and death. So please, engage in your exercises with great zeal and with great joy, and above all, with great outrageous playfulness. Learn to look with innocence upon all that arises. Abide lovingly with your creations. If you put these little exercises to work, much indeed will arise. Practice then, practice well, and practice with joy. Know that you are loved, loving, and lovable forever, and that in truth the only thing that is occurring is that an old dream is being released, that a new dream might replace it. The dream of worthiness, peace, wakefulness, and union with all of creation. Again, I say, I come not alone with this specific work, but I come with many who support your healing and your awakening. Therefore, indeed, be at peace this day, beloved friends. Abide lovingly with your creations. Amen. So it's not about discovering that there is no creation. It's about discovering at deeper and deeper levels how the tricks of our mind and perception continue to create the illusion of separation, continue to have us needing, wanting, yearning to define ourselves as separate so that we can be better than someone else, or we can even be worse than someone else. And there are some of us that are so well conditioned that we actually step through all kinds of hoops just to be able to see ourselves as worse than the people around us. So that's the first two lessons from Way of Mastery. And we will go back again at the beginning and start looking through the finer points of Lesson 1 and Lesson 2 as we move forward. And if you would have this be something other than just a lullaby or a bedtime story or some little entertainment that you engage in, you will need to cultivate actual effort on your part to do these exercises, to remind yourself of the first axiom. Nothing you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice. Please remember, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. For indeed, that aspect of the mind, the intellect, it was never designed to be your master. It was designed to be the humble, and if you will pardon the expression, very stupid servant of the awakened heart. This pathway, the Way of the Heart, the first book in the Way of Mastery, is about exercises, thoughts, questions, perceptions, learning to live in the question. Learning to question everything you think you know. Learning to approach every new moment in your life with childlike innocence. The awakened heart is that which feels all things, embraces all things, trusts all things, and allows all things. So much so that as we move on in this way of the heart, we're going to have a lesson that's simply titled, All Events Are Neutral. The awakened heart is that which feels all things, embraces all things, trusts all things, and allows all things. Everything. Every car accident, every physical illness, every personal betrayal, every ache or pain, the awakened heart is that which allows all things, feels all things, embraces all things, and trusts all things, and in that way transcends all things. The heart is that in which the soul rests eternally. The heart is that which is beyond space and time, and it is a spark of light in the mind of creation, which is called Christ. Only in that will you ever find the peace that you seek. You will discover that the pathway of awakening is a pathway of acceptance, not avoidance. It's a path of truthfulness and allowance and surrender. It is not a pathway of accomplishment and pride, but a pathway of releasing from the consciousness every hope and every wish to be special and to see yourself as having made progress. Imagine that for the Western mind. Imagine that you are intentionally engaging a process and a pathway in which you will see yourself as absolutely worth no more and no less than every other person that you encounter. The Western mind must be screaming at this thought. Why in heaven's name would I put myself on a pathway that will be working to get me to release from every corner of my consciousness every hope and every wish to be special? The Western mind will be screaming at this because from the moment of being taught language and being taught how to fit into a family and a community and a culture, we have been taught about either being special and how we are special or about how other people are more special than we are. So please understand, this is a pathway that if you start these exercises, your mind is going to be screaming. Your Western conditioned mind is going to be up in arms. Frequently, repeatedly, intensely up in arms. Because as you engage in the practice of these exercises, you will be moving yourself along the pathway in a process of removing from every corner of your consciousness every hope and every wish to be special and to see yourself as having made progress. Why would I be on a pathway, says the Western mind, unless I was going to make progress? The problem with that is in order to see myself as having made progress, I need to hold an assessment of myself that says I'm lacking. This pathway is a transcendence of the hope of somehow being special and getting some higher power's attention so that God or light or love or Jesus himself would say to you, oh my goodness, you've been such a good person. Yes, yes, we'll welcome you into the kingdom of heaven now. Come right this way. This pathway is going to ask us to cultivate, to work, to develop the willingness and the art of returning to the simplicity of empty-headedness, to the simplicity of not knowingness, and to do that with each and every breath. This pathway is a way of life in which all things and all events become an aspect of your meditation and your prayer until we realize more fully, more deeply with each breath, I'm not doing any of this. I didn't create myself. I don't even know when I was created. Something is breathing me. Something is keeping my heart beating. Something is living through me. I myself do nothing. Life, love, energy, creation, consciousness does all things through me. There's a point in Lesson 1 where it says, only the Creator's plan for salvation can work for you. And that reminds me of one of Guy Finley's lessons where he says, it is absolutely necessary that every attempt you make to know God, to get closer to God, every attempt you make fails miserably. Imagine that. Who wants to follow somebody like that? Guy Finley says, it's absolutely essential that every attempt you make to know God and creation fails miserably. What's the point then? The point then is, as you fail and you finally give up the thought that you're going to do it, that you're going to be the doer and the thinker separate from the mind of creation, that's when the mind of creation can step in and bring you that last bit, complete the cycle of the creative process, welcome you in as only creation can. You might say as only God can. You might say as only love can. But it's in the removing of the dream of separation. It's in the removing of the false perceptions that you could at any time be different than creation has created you to be. It's in that process that this pathway comes to fruition. Your will must always fail. For your way begins with the illusory and insane assumption that you're separate from the mind of God. And in that moment, you then think you have to determine your own course. How are you going to determine your own course? You're probably like every other human being on the planet, which means you have no idea how your food digests moment to moment. You have no idea how your body motivates when you get up to walk across the room. You have no idea when you were created or who created you. So how does it make any sense at all that you will be the director? You will be the creator of your movement along the path. This is a pathway of allowing. This is a pathway of awakening a remembrance, not just a remembrance of the intellect. It is not an idea as you would understand ideas. This is an idea. This is an energy that vibrates through the whole field of your beingness. So that even the cells of your body, while yet the body still remains coalesced together, awaken and relax into the truth that is true always. The truth that is true always is you remain as you were created to be. You are the extension of the creative energy in form. You are the extension of love in form. So we're asked to be wise gardeners. We're asked to understand that each and every thought that we select and pour our attachment into and our creative energy into creates our experience of life. So we're asked to be a wise gardener and to cultivate a deep love and respect for ourselves and to understand we are not here to fix the world. We're not here to fix our brother and sister. It is only love that does any of that fixing. It's only the energy of creation extending unimpeded through our minds that does that work. And until you've seen yourself totally as that extension of love, and you've purified your mind of every erroneous thought you've ever held, until you experience yourself as the energy of the love flowing unimpeded, you do not in truth know the energy of love and creation in yourself or anyone else. The wise gardener works and cultivates a state of consciousness through which the love of the Creator flows unimpeded. The way of the heart is the final pathway that any soul can enter. There are many pathways, and yet all roads lead to the same destination. Eventually, each soul must find its way into the way of the heart. Each soul must come back to the truth that it is time to take 100% responsibility to learn to cultivate the ability to look upon the deep and vicious blackness of what has been called the ego. Because that is nothing more than the cesspool of denial. And all it lacks is the light of awareness. Begin to bring the light of your awareness back to it by simply observing your own mind, observing your own behavior, and your own reactions, and observe them with a sense of wonder, the innocence of a child. The goal on this pathway is that we begin at the beginning and we learn to observe every thought with complete ownership and just marvel at it. Can you imagine looking upon the deepest, darkest parts of your own shadow mind, of your own denials, and just being able to say, huh, how about that? I just had a horrible thought about murdering my neighbor. Move through my consciousness. That thought is no more who I am. That thought does nothing to damage my value and my worth any more than a cloud moving through the sky damages the sky. Remember that everything is neutral, and all that arises within your consciousness has no effect whatsoever upon your actuality. And it has no meaning other than what you give it. The way of the heart is a way of cultivating the decision to become identified with the light, capital L light, that can shine away all darkness. Not by fighting with it. You don't go into a dark room and fight with the darkness to get it out of there. You don't go in with a bulldozer or a shovel or a broom to try and sweep the darkness away. The way of the heart is a way of cultivating the decision to become identified with the light, capital L light, full acceptance, full conscious awareness, because that light, that full-on absolute acceptance of consciousness can shine away all darkness. It shines away the darkness not by fighting with it, but by recognizing it, embracing it as its own creation, and choosing again. Choose again. Take a breath. Release, relax, Disconnect any attachment from tightness and tension and choose again. This is the way that calls you home, back to a destination that you never left. The strange thing about this is, the more you choose to do these exercises, you will be given this work in a way that as you do it, it will begin to transcend what your mind may choose to think of as these energies. So you will learn to lead more and more with the body and your feeling nature rather than your intellect. Why? Well, because we spend a lot of time conditioning the intellect and learning and going to school and being punished and rewarded in certain ways to fill the intellect with what this pathway would call trivialities. And your intellect doesn't know anything except what's been shoved into it by the culture, by your family, by your education. And this pathway calls that the garbage into a garbage can. The intellect can never bring you the healing of the heart that is the atonement, the at-one-ment. The intellect can play a role, but its role is to argue against the insane perceptions that you've been given so that you might come to see perhaps there's a greater good in giving up your insistence on treating the intellect as your God. So again, at the end of lesson one, we're called to dance, rejoice, and play often. In that first lesson, two different people, as we went through the first lesson, talked about, wait a minute, it talks about serious, and aren't we supposed to be serious? Aren't we seriously supposed to be committed to love, etc.? And the warning in this work is, to avoid seriousness, to avoid taking ourselves so seriously. The call is to dance, rejoice, and play often. That comes up as a call, a clarion call at the end of the first lesson. It also comes up again, as we just finished reading, at the end of the second lesson. Engage in your exercises with great zeal, with great joy, and above all, with great outrageous playfulness. Learn to look with innocence upon everything that arises. Abide lovingly with all of your creations. And mind you, if you do these little exercises and put them to work, much will arise from within you. Much bitterness, much fear, much consternation, much judgment, it will arise. Learn to look on it with innocence and playfulness and abide lovingly with it. In the first lesson it says, you know, we are asked to bring a loving view every place within our consciousness that fear has made a home. That's in the original promise. If you bring everything that is in your mind to this altar, to this process, and you look at it lovingly, playfully, with acceptance, and if you let this pathway teach you how to look lovingly upon every place that fear has made a home in your mind, and you allow a correction to happen, it will come. That reminds me of the quote from the Thomas Gospel where it says, if you bring forth what is within you will heal you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, What is within you will consume you. This can be looked at, the quote from the Thomas Gospels and what we're called to in the first and second lessons can be looked at as the process of dismantling denial. You know, a lot of people hear that Thomas Gospel quote and they say, well, what the heck does that mean? Well, how about it's very simple. If I'm in denial, I'm not in health. I'm not in the flow of life. I'm not going to grow. I'm not going to expand. I'm going to be blaming others for any negativity that I experience. If I end all denial, if I look lovingly upon all of my creations as this lesson and the second lesson call us to, I end denial and the atonement, the at-one-ment is created. The false nature of the ego is seen as false. And healing happens at levels hitherto unseen. Waiting for the opportunity to use the word hitherto. If you get on this pathway and you put the effort in, it's not hard work, it's just the focus of attention. It will come to pass that you will know the perfect peace of empty-headedness and not knowingness. In other places, it's called divine ignorance. Walking into each new moment of life, observing, I don't know what anything is or is for. I don't know what my brother or sister needs. I don't know what I need. That's why that quote from Guy Finley is so powerful. It's essential that every effort I make to know God fails, because the mind that can create the desire to know God has already created the dream of separation from the Creator, from the rest of creation. But that is a dream. There is no separation from the rest of creation. So the mind that says, I want to find God, I want to get back to God, I want to go home, is the mind that's created the illusion of separation, of a distance from the goal that was never left. So the second lesson comes right back and is titled, You Create Your Experience. And it begins with reinforcing the great joy that can be achieved when we step onto this pathway and recognize we're not in it alone. We've never been connected from the rest of creation and the rest of our brothers and sisters. We've never been separated from the Christ mind. And the voice that will guide you has always been within you. It's a voice that will steal quietly through the space between your own thoughts. And it is the ability to know of that, the existence of that, and learn to listen for that, that we are supporting, that we're promoting for each and every person who stumbles across this pathway. We want people to question everything that's being presented. Learn to question it for yourself. Learn to observe of your own life in the moment. Question everything. Learn to live in the question, as Rilke would call us to do. And that is the only way I know to learn and to continue to grow. We talk over and over again about how observation is highly preferable to knowing and to belief. This second lesson calls us and tells us that your body is a communication device. That's its purpose. And communication is creation. So, if you would create well, this course asks you to stay questioning for yourself, to be observing continuously for yourself. What are you committed to communicating? What will your words and actions and therefore your creations express? What will your words, actions, thoughts, creations express to others? Because what we seek to convey communicates to others the truth of what we believe about ourselves and the world. Therefore, beloved friends, as we begin to focus on, to refine, to deepen, to mature in the way of the heart, it's wise to begin at the beginning. What's the beginning? I want to be wise. I want to start at the beginning. What's the beginning? The beginning of this pathway is simply this. It couldn't get much more simple. You are as the Creator created you to be. You are an infinite focus of consciousness. Your very sense of existence is nothing more than a feedback loop or a feedback mechanism so that you can witness the effects of the choices you're making. Those choices are being made by you, perhaps not at the conscious level, but they are definitely being made at the very deep, deep depth of your mind. That depth of your mind that rests right alongside the heart of creation and the mind of God, the Christ mind itself. That's the beginning of this pathway. Remind yourself, observe directly for yourself. You remain as you were created to be. You are an infinite focus of consciousness. Your very sense of existence is simply that feedback mechanism that allows you to witness the effects of the choices you're making at the depth of your soul. If you don't like the results you're getting, over and over again, the Course in Miracles and Way of Mastery ask you to feel free to choose again. Choose again. Choose again. Choose again. With each new breath, in each new moment. And it's highly recommended in the Course of Miracles that you don't make any decisions alone, that you ask for guidance from the Great Comforter or the Holy Spirit to whenever you decide to choose again because you have not been pleased with the consequences of your actions, thoughts, and choices. So this is a Friday. We'll be back again on Monday. Thank you all for being here. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I hope you have a really good weekend.
Thanks. Same to you. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Friday, January the 28th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. We have really had some good conversation going on this week, and I hope that today is the same with people calling in and asking questions. We've got several people that are doing the self-study, and I've told a couple of them to call in and ask their questions, so I hope that they do. And we'll give Michael just a moment to get dialed in. I invite you to go to our website, which is www.whyagain.org. And you can click on the Start Here button, or you can click on, you can scroll down and click the bullseye in the middle of the page. We've added several things. I'm getting ready to, I've got a to-do list of things to add to the website. probably under the page that's classified as more from the app so that people can access it from the app as well. A couple of those things that I'm looking at putting out there is the special shows of the Beatitudes, the where we did the wake-up sheet several days on the radio show. We went through the wake-up sheets and everything from the app. And so there's a lot of information, and the app continues to grow. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here once again to share this space and to help us to inquire into the nature of first century Aramaic forgiveness. How do we step out of the extinction event of the insanity of hostility and fear and eating food that is based in something other than what it's designed for? How do we step out of that? And if you go back into this ancient Aramaic language, you find that there was a gentleman there who was a physicist, a physiologist, a geneticist, a psychologist who answered that question. How do you maintain life? How do you bring forward this presence of love that you are so that you truly live as a human being? And that's really the bottom line of everything that we're talking about with this work. And all of the tools that we've developed over the decades of bringing that teaching to life is what we're here to support. We're here to support being able to shift out of the conversation of the culture based in hostility and fear and to shift that game. And I came across a quote by Liam Neeson that I thought was just really powerful. He says, "Everyone says love hurts." I remember the song, "Love Hurts." So everyone gets these things confused. That's not true. But in reality, love is the only thing in the world that covers up all pain and makes one feel wonderful again. Pretty powerful response. Love is the only thing in this world that does not hurt, says Neeson. And I thought it was interesting coming from his mouth that he's been through his share of trauma in the world to come forward with that sort of an insight. I thought was quite powerful. And when you realize that love is a state of being that literally enlightens this mind and body, it's the active presence of love that is the light in which truth becomes visible. If we are enamored at all with truth, if we choose to own truth, it becomes visible and it really, truly becomes the only viable option. And so the whole idea of this work is to recognize that if it's not based in love, there's work to be done. And the work, the primary work, is that of forgiveness. And in truth, you forgive until you've let go of everything that's unlike your newborn nature. If you've ever held a newborn, you know, we've asked this question of tens of thousands of people all over the globe, and everyone always describes the newborn's essence with a word that's some variation on the theme of love. Now, if you go back, if you hold that newborn, is the newborn loving you or is the newborn love? It's pretty clear that love is a noun and we offer it as a state of being, and it's one that I can maintain with practice, of course, no matter what somebody else does. It's the key to healing self, others, and the world. Now, our culture's misled us into believing and thinking that love is a verb, so I attempt to love you, and that's an impossibility. Only the deluded think they can love another. The effort we want to put into is remembering and living as who and what we really are. There can never be a difference between what you really are and what love is. And if I enter into the practice of holding to that space in your presence, now I've achieved the goal. It's, Yeshua never said, love your neighbor. Never happened. Never was spoken. It was have rachma for your neighbor. And rachma is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that allows love to remain present in you. I can embrace you in my being, but that's not loving you. That's me functioning as love. And when I'm not experiencing that presence of love, it's an inside job. I'm the one who have deleted my awareness of it from myself. And whatever I've used to delete it, whatever I've used to block it, and it's usually some form of hostility or fear, that's the inside job that needs to be taken care of. And that sort of energetic pattern warns of us of its presence after it's been ignored time and time again. You know, the energy that we choose to engage in, that we choose to create our lives by, literally hits a cell. The cell biologists are telling us that when you think a thought, that thought produces in your body a neuropeptide, an actual molecule, and that molecule lands somewhere on your cell where there's a receptor site and somewhere in your structure, and it sets off a signal that reflects the quality of its presence to the cell. And that's either going to be a signal that, yeah, this feels good, wonderful, we're right on track, or it's going to be some form of hostility or fear. A signal comes early, and if we ignore it and ignore it and ignore it and ignore it, the cost becomes higher and higher and higher and higher, because the assault to our tissue structure, as we refuse to become responsible, you know, the mind's always got somebody else to blame, the assault to our tissue structure becomes deeper and deeper, and one experiences deeper and deeper levels of pain. And they think that pain is physical, but it's really not. It's the energetic assault of a neuropeptide on a cell, repeated assault from that same pathway, from that same neuropeptide, that is of a disintegrative nature. Now, in the process, if you engage in that of healing what's not loving you, it will be your own hostility and fear-based, literally, neuropeptides that you will encounter. And by removing those neuropeptides from the cell, the damage being done by the cell, or to the cell, pardon me, is removed. The damaging energy is removed, and the cell is able to go back to its natural shape. Now, we've all got deficiencies, but and most of us use the excuse of someone else's deficiency to say, that's why I'm hostile. I'm only because of you. That's why I attack. It's because of you that I have pain or depression, whatever. And as the healing process happens, that's going to come up again, that energetic pattern. And if we keep playing the game of whoever's present, we'll blame them. Of course, it's their fault. Yes, I've been through this 87 different times with 42 different people for decades and decades. And oh, yeah. But this time it's actually truly their fault. Another's deficiency is not the cause of our hostility, our pain. And just need to remember that every time it's happened, we've been there. And there's nothing in another's behavior that requires us to stoop to their level. The only one who suffers from your own hostility, rage, guilt, grief, pain is you. When we engage in it, we get the original. Someone else gets a carbon copy. And they may not be home for delivery. And the test that verifies whether or not a feeling, you can tell whether or not it's actually yours or not, is, are you feeling it? If you're feeling it, you know who it belongs to. And so we have a whole series of tools that we've developed. Everything from, and we've talked in the last few days about the commitment. You know, we've talked about the definition of life, and that life is love flowing through a cell. And when I take responsibility for maintaining my own human life, love within me, I am going to have to forgive the habit in myself that set that pain in motion in the first place. Someday I'm going to have to remember that. I'm feeling this, this is mine, even though my mind can construct a picture world that attaches my pain to my brain's image of someone else, and I can be sure that it's theirs. But the assaults that I do, I assault first my own tissue structure and reinforce my own pain. So the idea of maintaining this condition of love, you know, if we go back and when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law, as I said before, he never said love your neighbor or yourself or as yourself or the creator. In essence, the end result, the word he used was rachma, filter in the frontal lobes of the brain, that is a gateway for life to enter into this human form. That's its primary motive. That's its primary mechanism of action. So life, being love flowing through a cell, your responsibility is enhance and make sure that that love continues to flow and that anything that restricts or limits it, anything that inhibits it, and that's usually hostility or fear, is your responsibility to remove. And the removal process is called forgiveness. So forgiveness is removing anything that interferes with the flow of love in your structure. Anything that interferes with your human life, because that active presence of love is literally your life. And we all started out with it. And we pretty much all had it assaulted. And we pretty much follow the patterns of assault that our power persons did to us. No one is a thug. But one's own behavior is perhaps thuggish. Like all hostile minds, I'm talking about all of us. But like all who've lost their way, the conscious active presence of love can bring us back. Back to that space of active love. If you haven't worked with a commitment recently, or you haven't been on the show, we did talk about it the other day, but it just strongly comes to me to share it again today. Promise to trust you enough to tell you the truth and be true to you. I commit to always be sweetness in your life, to nurture you daily and treat you lovingly, gently, and with respect. In my thoughts, words, and actions, whether in your presence or not. In every interaction, I commit to affection for you, to look for and acknowledge the highest and best in you as I surrender to love, our true nature. I will use only voice tones that reflect my deep caring for you. And when we step into living that commitment, everything unlike what it is we're saying is going to have to surface. So I'm going to remember that my connection to my source, my relationship with you, and our serenity is always more important than any issue. I open my being to embrace you in my love. So I'm going to imagine myself being able to open at the highest levels of my being to hold you and at the same time be in the space where I'm willing to have you do the same. To be embraced in your love. As I said the other day when we were sharing this, if you do that, then everything that's unlike love is going to start to move in you. So the next paragraph of the commitment is what you're going to do when that happens. So if anything unlike love comes up, I'll hold this in my heart and listen. As I learn to speak, experience, and be responsible for my own realities, I'm here for and with you. I promise to keep communication open and keep love conscious, active, and present as we heal, celebrate life, and grow together. So that's where we were envisioning going. Mahatma Gandhi said we must make the injustice visible. I offer that making justice invisible. It must be done in the context of love and start with the injustices in our own hearts. We must honor truth enough to do that. And that subtle work of internal healing needs to be done before one can hold self and others accountable. Holding a space of love for the quote-unquote offenders of the world, those who don't think like you, is a skill that must be acquired by those who would become healers, and it has to start with self. It's an interesting piece of writing that was done by a man named Bahá'u'lláh. Bahá'u'lláh is a man who started the Baha'i Faith, one of the world religions that came out of the Aramaic language, and actually fairly recently, 1700s, if I remember correctly. And he writes so beautifully about what it's going to look like when you achieve the level of inner work that we're talking about, when that's completed. Here's what he writes it will look like. Should any come to blows with you, seek to be friends with him. Should any stab you in the heart, be a healing salve to his sores. Should any taunt and mock at you, meet him with love. Should any heap his blame upon you, praise him. Should he offer you a deadly poison, give him the choicest honey in exchange. And should he threaten your life, grant him a remedy that will heal him evermore. Should he be in pain itself, be ye his medicine. Should he be thorns, be ye his roses and sweet herbs. Perchance, such ways and words from you will make this darksome world turn bright at last. Will make this dusty earth turn heavenly, this devilish prison place become a royal palace of love, so that war and strife will pass and be no more. And love and trust will pitch their tents on the summits of the world. I thought that was a very powerful piece of writing from Bahá'u'lláh. Thank you for that. And he's a man who knew, he's a man who, because of his teaching based in love and his criticism of war, was put in prison and tortured. And I don't even know the whole crazy story, but it wasn't exactly the way he was treated. Turned that into his teacher. So our objective with this work, is to remember the importance of that possibility and how the mind can twist it and turn it in a thousand directions. That word love especially, you know, if you remember Vladimir Lenin said that if you want to destroy a culture, change the meaning of its words. And recognize that love describes a state of being, what you are. And it seems like a subtle refinement, but it really is an important one if you're going to live as a true human being. Instead of attempting or setting the goal to attempt to love someone as though you could possibly do love, you want to set the goal to experience yourself as love in every circumstance and then forgive or remove anything unlike love that surfaces till the only thing left is you. So that's in a nutshell the most basic course in this work and the most advanced course in this work. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of the conversation. Remembering that each time you dip into a new level of vitality, it's going to serve up a new level of what it is that you've always said you never want to deal with and you never want to feel again. And remember, once again, if you're feeling it, it's yours. If you ignore it, deny it, dissociate from it, and project it into your brain's image of someone else and talk as though they're the cause of your pain, then you'll drive that pain still deeper. So that's what we're here to learn. That's what we're here to teach. That's what we're here to bring to the world. We want to move out of this belief that the Greeks gave us that we're supposed to love one another and move into a world where we recognize that our job description is really, truly that of achieving a life where we live 24/7, 365 as a state of love. And when you realize that in you are 1,000 generations of other than that, then 1,000 times 1,000 calls will come that will bring up those voices from the past. When they force this Greek, they impose this Greek meaning for love into Yeshua's mouth, left us stuck in this error upon which most of other errors rest. When we lose the awareness of ourselves as love, that's when the mind starts to go into all the crazy things that people try to do to force the achievement of their goals. One command, love one another, falsely spoken and believed, leaves us striving to do the impossible. The other, in Aramaic, explains something that's very achievable. The power of life and death is in our words, Yeshua said 2,000 years ago. And the meanings we hold for them are key. If you recognize that this word love describes a state of being, that is your birthright to live, then that's going to become prime directive. And know the truth and the truth will set you free. But most people don't really want the truth. We talked about the movie, It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. And the basic message that, to me, is demonstrating that film is this character who's interacting with Mr. Rogers, basically has no interest whatsoever in actually looking at the truth about his life. He does everything to escape it. The basic message he gives back to Mr. Rogers is a message that many give to life, and that is, don't make me look. I will force you to shut up if you try to make me look. And then I will make you the bad guy because I don't want to look at what's mine. So that's what we're here to understand and incarnate, bring into the world. And we're delighted that you're part of the conversation and here to be in the learning and the teaching of it. And so, Ms. Janie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anybody in the chat room with a thought for us?
No, it's all quiet. We have 33 minutes, so we have plenty of time. Press 1. A hand just went up. 904, I believe.
Great.
This is Dusty. You're on the air.
Well, hey there, young man. How are you? Are you with us, Dusty? Is your phone on mute? Your hand is up. Janie's opened your microphone, Dusty. Are you with us? If not, maybe if you can hear me, maybe you want to hang up and dial back in again. Let's try this again because it doesn't seem to be working from your end. Can't hear you. And is Dusty still on, Jeannie?
No, he hung up. So let's give him just a minute and see
okay.
if he dials back. Back
so
in.
Give him a second and see if he calls back in again. Hello, Dusty. How are you? It's interesting while we're waiting for Dusty to come back in that there are so many ideas in the Aramaic language that there aren't even symbols. We don't even have grunts or groans or words. So what we call words. Oh, there he is. Hey, young man.
Oh, hi. It actually
I
works.
I can hear you.
Yay.
How do you be? Yeah, you're working loud
well,
and clear.
Well, gosh, how about that? The marvels of modern technology. Yay, finally.
You know, it is really amazing. I mean, here I am in Bristol, Virginia. Here you are in Florida, and we've got a network up in, I believe it's in New York or New Jersey, that's hooking us together. And, you know, Bob's down there in Australia listening. Maybe Peter's in where's Peter? He's in Sweden. Pippi is in Thailand.
On.
And here we are all having a conversation. How cool is that?
Yeah, I think that's just marvelous. It reminds me of my early ham radio days when the magic was like, oh, my goodness. You know, when
right.
most people didn't have that. So, you know, I was going to ask you a question about something that happened a few days ago, but one thing that popped into my mind a couple of days ago, you know how the Greeks seem
right.
to want to slap their own little variation of anything on anything. It came to me that the Greeks and the Romans, they just like stories. They love stories.
True.
Period. You know what I mean? That's part of it. And I was even thought about the geology of Greece and how it's just a lot of it's these little islands and it's in between Turkey and Rome. And what an interesting place. And I could see between the seafaring and et cetera, why they had so many stories. I mean, just based on the human dynamic of that. But I wanted to ask you a question. A week ago Monday, he said,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you can remember every word you said, that you were talking about how perception is generated of it's not from the outside in, it's from the inside out. You know,
right.
Your theory about something informs what you see. And
yes.
And you did something for me that was provocative. You mentioned that the CIA had done a study on that and come up with the same.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could elaborate on what you know about that study, their modus operandi, their application, whatever they were willing to release. Do you remember anything?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I want to go back just a few thoughts before I go into that particular piece of research from the CIA. When you talk about stories, you brought up a story that really gave Jeannie and I a deep picture into exactly what it was you were talking about. And back, and I'm not even sure what year it was now, but the year that the movie 300 was released. Have you seen that film?
Yes. Yes.
Well, the movie 300 was released in, yeah, well, when Jeannie and I traveled, especially, well, we still do it. It wasn't only when we travel, but our mode of play is watching movies. And we had done a particularly grueling week, and the week was over, and we decided, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, we had the day off, and we were going to go do a doubleheader. And we were in Tampa. And we looked at, you know, what was available, and the movie 300 was just opening in one theater. And then not far away, there was another movie that we'd heard of called Mystic India that we decided was going to be our second movie. So we went and saw 300, and man, talk about violent and vicious, and
it's your chest kind of violence. Yeah.
Unbelievable. But you see a mindset there that is so pervasive in our culture today with what's going on. And then, you know, we got in the car. I don't remember. I'm thinking we stopped and had lunch and then went and saw Mystic India. Have you seen that film?
It's a gentle film, right?
Oh, it's profoundly powerful. This young man, at the age of, I'm not even sure, 12 or 13, maybe even 10, knows why he's here as a human being to teach. You know, basically, I mean, we felt right at home because it's right in harmony with what we're doing. And his family, you know, didn't particularly support that. And so he literally, it's a true story, and if I remember correctly, it was maybe in the 1600s or 1700s, this man or this young boy went out and jumped in a pretty powerful raging river so that nobody could follow him or stop him. And he went on a pilgrimage where he walked around India. And I'm not remembering the details right now. We should probably dig that movie out and watch it again. But I'm thinking it was like something like 17 or 18 years. This kid just walked around covering thousands of miles, village upon village upon village, to teach what he knew he was here to teach, and that was that we are the presence of love. One particular scene that sticks out in my mind when I think about that story, and the reason I tell this when you brought up that idea of stories, is how different would the theology of this culture be if Yeshua had been presented through that culture, Mystic India, rather than through, in the Western world, the Greek culture? How different would it have been? There's one particular scene where this young man is, you know, he's 12 or 13, and he comes to this village where he sits down under a tree to meditate, and a priest comes out and says, hey, we've had a man-eating tiger in this village, and this is apparently a true story. And he says, you know, come in, you know, sleep in our temple where we can protect you. And the kid replies, can your temple protect me from death? And the priest, kind of, you know, confused, says, well, yeah, of course not, but come in and we'll protect you. He says, you know, basically it's just thanks, I'll just stay right here. And in the morning, according to the story, the man-eating lion was laying beside him, you know, kind of in meditation the same way the kid was. And that was the last time that lion attacked anyone. But when you think about all the stories and how much the focus in the Greek culture is on this idea of sin and violence and rejection and self-deprecation and not being worthy and not being good enough and not being any, you think about the stories that we've been told, that have led to a culture that supposedly is Christian but has 32,000 sects of Christianity, many of them supporting some of the worst violence that's ever been done in the world. And then you look at that culture, and if those stories, if that had come out of that culture, how different would our culture be? How different could the game be?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's funny that you're bringing this up, because a big thing in my life is that dichotomy between those two geographical areas, where my inner growth and being, it seems to come strongest and best from anything that was anywhere near the Himalayas and that way of thinking and being. And I had kind of given up on the whole, Mediterranean, Greco-Roman, et cetera, until I started hearing your program with the Aramaic, and of course there's beauty in everything, but I really like that even now, for instance, if you go to Nepal, Hinduism, which has been around for just practically forever, and Buddhism get along great. They even celebrate, some of them celebrate each other's festivals or days of this or that. In the West, the Protestant Christians are slaughtering, vice versa, the Roman Catholics. And I'm going, what?
It's crazy.
So I agree. I know. It's just nutso.
And the places where that kind of thing is happening is where the provocateurs show up and lie to both sides of the equation to set them at odds with each other. You know, if you go to Palestine, for thousands of years, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims got along. They were brothers. They cooperated. They lived in communities together. They took care of each other's children.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
There's a powerful film entitled The Other Son, if you haven't seen it. It's worth looking up. And it's about a Palestinian woman who is in Jerusalem, and there's some sort of an attack. Something happens. There, she's in the hospital delivering a child, and there's a Jewish woman in the same hospital delivering a child, and the hospital is attacked. And in the confusion of that attack, the two children get switched.
Whoops.
So the Jewish family is now raising a Palestinian boy, and the Palestinian parents are raising a Jewish son, and they don't know it.
Perfect.
Until the boys are of the age where, you know, in Jerusalem or in Israel, everybody has to serve in the army. And the father of this, what we find out is a Palestinian boy that he thinks is his son, gets notification, because when his son is inducted into the army, they do genetic testing, and they come back and find out, hey, buddy, this is not your son. And they go back and, you know, ferret out what happened, the switch of the two children, and go and inform the parents. And the trauma that, you know, everybody's going, I mean, it's a powerful place for processing, because, you know, here's this kid who's been learning what, you know, Jewish boys are taught about Palestinians, and all of a sudden he's like, oh my God, I'm one of them. And the Jewish kid has been taught everything he's been taught about Jews, only, and he thinks he's Palestinian. He realizes he's now a Jew, and the conflict of that. And then the parents, the father, who's the military guy, he doesn't want anything to do with this knowledge. No, that can't be true. Can't be my son. Can't. And, you know, just the resolution that they come to, what they need to deal with, it's really powerful film, if you haven't seen it.
Yes, it sounds like it. And it's funny
lots
you would say that, because I had a minor version of that in my life, in that when my mom and I, my dad had died, my mom and I moved to Idaho when I was about four, I wound up taking on the name of Henderson, this guy she married. So all the way, 1 through 12, 1 through 13 and a half, I was Dusty Henderson until I joined the Army. And then they looked at me and they went, whoop, sorry to tell you this, son, your real name's Young. And I went,
wow. So you didn't even have awareness of that?
No, I didn't know. I thought I'd been legally adopted, see, by this guy,
okay.
And I hadn't. So my real name was still really Young, and I was thrilled. I didn't want any part of the Henderson thing anyway.
Well, you told me about him, so, yeah, I can understand that from what you've told us about what that was like. Powerful.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's, oh, my goodness. So, it did hit me pretty strong about that whole story aspect of that region. And I still find it just beautifully amazing when I've seen documentaries on, you know, some places in Indonesia or wherever, anywhere that there's Buddhism and Hinduism side by side, and rarely are they at odds. They're usually on the same loving, you know, someplace together.
Except where the provocateurs are. The film Gandhi is a very powerful demonstration of that, too, because Gandhi was brought up. One of the scenes in the movie Gandhi, he speaks of how the whatever they called in his particular religion, what they called the spiritual leader. I mean, he would said one week we would read from the Quran, another week we would read from the Upanishads, another week we would read from the Christian text, and it didn't matter because it was all about the same thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then, you know, we have
these
constructs in our mind. Yeah. Yeah. Who was it that we have the privilege of being separated by a common language?
Well, that's nice. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Every now and then you come up with these great one-liners like that. I like it.
Yeah, I forget who said that. I think it might have been Winston Churchill, I think.
Oh, yeah. He did some beauts, yes.
Yeah. In any way, your question about the CIA.
Yes, yes. I'm curious as to what they actually let loose of what they studied.
Well, number one, you can go to our website and there's a link, or through the app you can get to the link and you can download the book free, or you can go to CIA.gov and search for The Study of Human Intelligence. The book is on their website. It's moved around a couple of times, so Jeannie has a link directly on our website to it. And
great.
So their study was, they're working with their intelligence agents, and what they're attempting to do is to understand how to get the best intelligence. You know, it seems they had the recognition that perception has a quality, and you know, somebody who's at a level one on a scale of 1 to 10 in perceptual quality, we would consider to be not very bright, and somebody who's at 10, well, they're a genius. And so their objective, as I understand it, was to upgrade the quality of the perceptual content of their agents' minds in order to get the best intelligence possible for their purposes. So there's a chapter in the book on this whole idea of perception. And here's the quote verbatim from the book. People tend to think of perception as a passive process. We see, hear, smell, taste, and feel stimuli that impinge upon our senses, that if we are at all objective, we record what is actually there. Yet perception is a demonstrably active process rather than passive. It constructs rather than records reality.
Mm.
Perception implies, they say, understanding as well as awareness. It is a process of inference in which people construct their own version of reality on the basis of information provided through the five senses. Now, I think they're totally, completely off base on that last sentence, because people don't construct their own version of reality on the basis of the information provided through the five senses. They construct their reality out of the interaction between the information that comes through the senses and what that information resonates or stimulates within an individual. And the thing that makes our perception unique as individual is the history stored within our structure, genetic and otherwise, that tell or project our story into the information that's coming into our senses.
See, that's what I see a lot. I see people who have their preconceptions or their, that saying, they who don't live, don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. Well, some people just repeat it, and they go around with a whole matrix. The truth can't come through. Some do. And project that on whatever they want. And guilty of that.
I don't think anybody wants to repeat a painful, traumatic experience. People are just ignorant and don't know that they're doing it to themselves. There's just no awareness.
Well, it's not necessarily it's directly happening that I'm thinking of. I'm just thinking of people that actually are kind of harmful. The harmful types that just would do it anyway, regardless.
Those without Rachma.
But yes. Yeah. But nobody wants to repeat pain if their own pain, if they can help it. And those with
unless
love,
they're in
I
the
suppose.
Realm of what they call the masochist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
I've
run into sadists. Too.
Yeah. You know what the sadist says to the masochist when the masochist says, beat me? The true sadist says no. Got it?
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, that's a little flipsy doodle. So the CIA thing, where did that come out at, kind of?
I'm not sure what you mean, where did it come out at?
Well, I mean, I understand what you said, that people kind of project or have a, it's not all objective, it's their perception of reality. Anyways, you were going on with how they were describing things. I like that. I wondered if there was any more of it.
Well, as I say, you can download. I just happen to have, I've got the quote in front of me that I've cut and put into my notes for reference. But as I say, you can download the whole book and read it. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Okay.
It's been a while since I've availed myself of it, but there's a lot of interesting material in it. You know, the way they carried out the studies and those sorts of things.
Right. In your opinion, do you think they did a pretty truthful disclosure, a study and disclosure, and for the most part got some things right?
Pretty objective. It kind of shocks me when, that last sentence that I read, that it is a process of inference in which people construct their own version of reality on the basis of information provided through the five senses. It amazes me that they didn't interject in there on the basis of what information that comes in through the five senses arouses in them. That's kind of mind-boggling. Didn't appear to understand that. They think it's just, the five senses. If that were true, everybody in the same room at the same time would have the same perceptual construct. And obviously, you and I know that we've been in rooms where there were two or more people whose perception of the events was not the same. And so each person is constructing their own based on the content of their minds, not just the information in the room. Pretty clearly.
Well, that makes sense. When in my video production business, I started off, I probably did hundreds of depositions where I would take a camera and a bunch of microphones and a mixer, and I would go off to someplace, a doctor's office or a court, at someplace, and there would be, I would, you know, set up the camera and the microphones. And anyways, that whole thing, and that's what it did. It was court admissible. And it was interesting to me that I knew that I could, if I wanted to, ever so unconsciously bias the viewer by just
tweak those things,
the camera and things. Yeah, but I would never, did that. I always kept it straight on. I kept everything just as clean and as objective as I possibly could. But I knew of those things, and I was always tickled by how little it takes, slightly bias something. For instance, since I went on it, if I lowered the camera just a bit more, so we're looking up at the deponent, whoever is testifying, it seems to give them a little more credulity, whereas if I raise the camera and now we're looking down, a little less. Ever so subtle, but it might make the difference in a court of law.
Right.
Little things like that. And I'm, of course, I just never did that. I would never do that because that wasn't what I was there for.
Interesting. Well, certainly we see the effects of that in the media world all the time, how the story of the people in the room isn't the story that the video tells. It's like, well, how did you do that? I guess there are a lot of tricks in that world.
Well, yeah, there's too much that can be manipulated in the digital world, and so it's hard to know any kind of fact from fiction except your own direct perception. But I also wanted to add that Monday, a week ago last Monday, when you were talking that was a very dynamic presentation, my brother. I was really impressed in that you were so succinct, but yet so heartfelt and just had the energy for it. And then I started thinking, you've been doing this for 10 years. So doing this must energize you in some way or rock your boat or something, or you'd be getting way weary of it by now.
Well, you know, how enthused do you get when you're on purpose?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
There it is. I mean, one of the workshops we do is called Purpose, Personal Power, and Commitment, and we invite people to start to look at whether they've been brainwashed into doing something that isn't in harmony, and that's when they get tired of it, or when they get clear. We've got an exercise we give people for determining what their purpose is, and then we suggest they start to set their lives up and their goals up on purpose. And all of a sudden, you know, things get a whole lot more exciting because we're being fed as we live what we're here for. If we're here to do a job for a buck, you don't get fed by that. I mean, you know, the belly might get fed, but the being doesn't. And shifting out of you know, working for a living into doing what your purpose is. And, you know, I mean, I could do this all day long.
Oh, yeah. Well, you sound like you could, and I think it's amazing that you two have that. I call it the dog and pony show with the highest affection, but I love the way you and Jeannie interact on this whole thing. It's just great.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. And when we do an intensive at Heartland, there are days where I'll be up in front of the room teaching, you know, basically what we're doing here for as much as 10 or 11 hours a day.
Wow.
And do that for 65 days straight.
Man, that's, So
at
Heartland,
you have to
love it.
At our teaching center.
Yeah.
Oh, I do. It's food for me. But at Heartland, we'll do a summer season, and our summer season includes usually a 65-day intensive, and that's 65 days, day by day, we're just in the throes of every angle and every piece of information. You know, we'll do laws of living, we'll do teacher training, we'll do why is this happening to me again, healing through relationships, intuitive development, A Course in Miracles. We'll just do, you know, one right after the other after the other. And easily, you know, it's kind of fun because about, you know, the first, second, or third day, somebody who's registered for the 65 days will start to say, well, wait a minute now, how can we do this for 65 days? That's ridiculous. I mean, how could we do that? And then along about day 63 or 64, the conversation is, well, we're not going to stop already, are we? We've just gotten started. We're just scratching the surface. Really, truly. I mean,
wow.
That's what it feels like. It's
wow,
like,
that's amazing. Because like, I've never heard of an intensive that went much past 2 weeks or a month at the most, but 65 days? Wow.
Yeah. And again, at say 63, it feels like we're just scratching it. It's like people are moving into deeper and deeper levels of process, literally. You know, when you think about that research that says in a time frame, you know, out of Harvard, that says in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, our perception is made up of 9 bits, and you realize there's a veil, there's a barrier that blocks us from what's being held in that unconscious. The whole process of this work deepens, it opens that veil, that barrier, and it deepens contact with one's own unconscious dynamics. And when you start moving into that realm, and then you start getting to the level where your genetics are opening, it's pretty profound.
Yeah.
And then we, one of the things we talk about are, you know, the metaphorical is presented in the scriptures, the 5 smooth stones of David, and that there are 5 higher spiritual faculties that were being talked about. And as you start to open those faculties, that just literally opens a whole other realm.
That's,
and that's
good
what
stuff,
it's all
brother.
About. It is good. It is
wow.
good stuff. It's pretty exciting to do.
In a way, and I know we're drawing close on time, but in a way, as I'm hearing that, it occurs to me it's kind of a loose parallel, but it has the same dynamic. I heard Ann Wilson of the musical group Heart, you know, the two gals that had that home, you know, were very powerful pop stars for a while. And she said something more succinctly. I'd heard some blues musicians say, women mostly, say the same thing. But she said, I have to have a song. The song has to be authentic for me. Meaning
right.
that, you know, pablum like little puppy dog, gloves, love things. No, that's not where she's at right now. So it needs to be authentic
yeah.
for her. And when I heard that, she sort of set me free in a way on that, because I had had a tendency to change a word or two every now and then to make it maybe not as dark or more authentic to me. And the more I do that, the more I find out that I can change anything I want to. If that way I can own it. And if I can own
They're
the song, then I can get inside it and inhabit it.
Right.
And that's the only way
Aligned
I know how to do it. And there's
out of your purpose. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it becomes kind of what you're talking about. You're in your passionate groove there, and you've got something bright that you're teaching. And I just think that's amazing. That I still can't hardly believe 65-day intensive, man.
That's objective. And I just realized we're right down to the last few seconds. The phone is going to cut us off any second, so I'm just going to thank you for the conversation. Appreciate you, my friend. Blessings.
You too. Bye-bye.